Start?
Yes, the bells are on.
All right, I'm going to start now. All right, so we're looking at Matthew 6, and we're still in this overall section in 1 through 18 when Jesus gives this general warning in verse 1. Do you remember what the general warning or the general statement regards?
Take heed.
Yeah, take heed that about what?
Righteousness.
Good, that you're not doing your deeds of righteousness to be seen by other people, to receive their praise, things like that. And so he's going to continue this discussion, and he's going to make further application to prayer, and then he's going to add fasting to the end of all of this. And so we'll see how these things are connected to each other in just a second here. But as we look at this, do you guys remember in the Gospel of Matthew, how many blocks of teaching does Jesus have? 5. And you see all of them end with something similar to a saying like this, where it says when he finished these sayings, you see it at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Chapter 10 has a teaching section, 13 is the parable one, 18 is the one about kingdom living, and then 26 is about judgments and final things and stuff like that. And so this is the first of Jesus' main teaching sections in the Gospel of Matthew. Anybody remember who that kind of reminds us of in the Old Testament? Yeah, Moses had 5 sections of teaching. Again, Matthew's written to a Jewish audience, proving to them that Jesus is the perfect Jew that they were waiting for. So it makes sense that Jesus would be painted in those kinds of ways. Remember also, what's the theme passage of the Sermon on the Mount then? What's maybe one way that you could characterize what the whole thing's about? And we saw it in chapter 5. Yes, that our righteousness has to exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. And throughout the Sermon on the Mount, he's been showing that their righteousness was just all external, but they were more like a whitewashed wall that had a lot of cracks, but externally it looked good, but they covered it up with the paint, like Acts 24 would show. Alright, so one other thing to say about this, I'm trying to remember, there's some secular kind of atheist sort of people that have written about the Sermon on the Mount, and said that the Sermon on the Mount is a terrible piece of literature because it makes you feel terrible about yourself. Have you guys ever read the Sermon on the Mount and just thought that you're a pretty good person? I don't think anybody would really do that unless they're kind of deluded about themselves. But right after the Sermon on the Mount, do you know what Jesus does in chapters 8 and 9 of Matthew? He does a series of miracles. And look at what kinds of miracles he does in chapters 8 and 9. He cleanses a leper. How is sin described in the Bible at times? Or what's a good metaphor for sin? Leprosy is. You've got a guy that is that has demon possession at the end of chapter 8. You've got a guy that's paralyzed in chapter 9. How many of you felt spiritually paralyzed when you've read the Sermon on the Mount? That you're not walking in these paths of righteousness and all of these different sorts of things. And so one thing I would say about this is that chapters 8 and 9, right after he humbles you, he's showing you that he has the power and the ability to lift you up and to heal you of your deepest problems. And so maybe that's some things to say about the overall context of this section in Matthew. But this morning we're going to look at prayer and fasting and how they're coupled together. In the Bible, here's some references of where prayer and fasting are used together, depending on your translation in Matthew 17:21 and 1 Corinthians 7:5. And so these things are going to be put together here in this text. So maybe something to say about this, and we'll say more about it when we get to the fasting section. Have you ever noticed in your life that if you try to get really good about eating healthy, sometimes that bleeds over into being better financially, and like one discipline can oftentimes help the other. Prayer and fasting kind of function in that way because a lot of the times people would pray in the Bible and it would be strengthened or enhanced by their fasting. And we'll get more to that when we look at that. But here we could outline what we're looking at this morning. Verses 9 through 15, he's going to talk about prayer. And then 16 through 18, he's going to talk about fasting. In this section, in verses 1 through 18, prayer is the thing that gets the most attention. All right, any comments or questions just by way of introduction before we start looking at the text? All right, so let's look at what I'm calling anyways the disciples' prayer. Let's see. Danny, do you want to read verses 9 through 15 for us, please?
In this manner, therefore, pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. For if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses.
All right. Let's just think just for a brief second here how this prayer is oftentimes characterized. Growing up, sometimes I'd go to Lutheran church, and they called this the Lord's Prayer, and we would recite it every Sunday that we would get together. But notice that in verse 9, Jesus says, pray like this. I'm asking you to pray like this. So this is actually a model prayer for Christians. I would say that the disciples' prayer, or the Lord's Prayer, is actually John 17. That's the high priestly prayer when he's praying to the Father. That's the Lord's Prayer. This is the disciples' model prayer, or like a template that might be helpful for us to think about as we're praying. Something else to say about this in verse 7. Remember when Jesus says that the Gentiles pray, thinking that they'll be heard for their many words? Some versions talk about how they pray in a vainly repetitious sort of manner. Sometimes you can do that with this prayer that we're looking at. But it's important to see that he says to pray like this or in this manner. Let this be a template for the way that you approach God in prayer. All right. Anything you guys want to say just about the characterization of what we're looking at here? All right, let me ask this question, and I'm not sure that I have figured out an answer that fully satisfies me, but sometimes this model prayer that he gives here, we're going to study it, we're going to look at it kind of line by line in just a second, but have you ever asked this question, why is this prayer here in the context that it's in? Because what's verses 1 through 18 about, again? Not doing your deeds to be seen by men, right? For the praise of men? So, if that's the overall context, why does Jesus spend a little extra time giving us a model prayer in that context? What do you guys think? Does that question make sense?
At least the way I look at it, it seems like it's more for the context of the prayer itself.
Good. So maybe something to say then, if you're seeking the praise of men, could you ever sincerely pray this prayer? No, because who's it focused on? Well, it starts with God, and then he gets to our needs, but really the first things that are centered on God are still things that we need. But it's framed in a completely different way than a self-centered person. And so if you're seeking the praise of men, you never end up praying the way that this passage says to pray. So maybe that's a good barometer for us to think about. As we look at this prayer, if you ask yourself, do I ever pray like this? And if the answer to that question is no, I might be more of a Pharisee than I realize, because Pharisees wouldn't pray this way. Something else to say about this is that if we are more like a Pharisee, I think the discipline of praying like this orients ourselves away from the mindset of a Pharisee. Yeah.
So how would we reconcile like Luke 11, for example?
Where he says to pray it.
Where he actually goes through this exact same thing, because the disciples actually in Luke 8 see him pray. And then they implore him to teach us to pray like that, and then he recounts this same prayer.
And in Luke 11, he doesn't say, pray like this. He says to pray this. Is that what you're saying?
No, pray in this manner, but what he's doing is he's teaching the disciples how they ought to pray.
Right.
When they see, they observe how he prays and realizes, this is different. This is not like how the Pharisees would pray, or how their religious practices regarding prayer would happen. So this was his answer.
Right.
Tell him this way.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Anything else you guys want to say just about that question? I think that's an important question to think about. So we're not just isolating this, but we're understanding what the purpose of it is in the first place.
I'm just thinking about what Dan was saying. for the disciples, would our Father in heaven, would that be something that a Jewish person would not normally address God as Father? Is that something normal they would do? Is that, to hear them say that, would that, to them, would that mean something that the relationship is a lot, because that would infer some intimacy and something else that maybe before they would not look at God in that fashion. Would that be odd to them when Jesus said to use those words?
Yeah. So let's get to how he addresses them here. That's a good question. In the Old Testament, do you have pictures of God being the Father of the people of Israel, or do you see people addressing God as Father? What are some of the metaphors God uses in the Old Testament to describe his relationship with his people?
Well, one is a marriage.
Right.
Is one way.
Hosea does that.
Yeah.
Remember in Exodus 4:22 when God is wanting Pharaoh to let them go, and he's telling Moses how he's supposed to go approach Pharaoh, and he's supposed to say that Israel is my firstborn son. That's one of the first times I think we see that phrase in the Bible. And so in Exodus 4:22, the nation is pictured as a son of God. But I don't see it all throughout the Old Testament, though, people addressing God in this way. And so maybe part of what Jesus is doing here is he's helping us know the kind of intimacy and the kind of access that we can have with the Father. Now, a father, okay, Bill Gates, if I was to try to call him right now, he wouldn't answer me. I don't even have his number. But what if I was his son and I tried calling him? Do you think he'd answer?
Yes.
Probably. And so you've got God being our Father, and if he's our Father, that means that we do have access to him, and this means that it's not a business transactional kind of relationship. And this is, by the way, how the pagans would pray, right? In right before this, where they thought they would be heard for their many words. If they can just babble on long enough and impress their gods and inform their gods enough, then the gods will finally answer their prayers. With God, it's not like that. It's a father-son relationship, which means that it's not based on if you can say the right words and if you can do something for me, then I'll do something in return for you. But I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No, that's what I was thinking about, the same thing. I know that's what they said Gentiles would utter, the kind of way to just wear their gods out to try to get them to pay attention.
Right.
So I just, when he said playing this matter, they heard Jesus addressing God as Father.
Right.
And said, that's not something we normally hear. And then he tells you, you can do this as well.
Right.
That's what I'm just wondering, is that kind of what maybe the strange thing about his prayer is him talking to God as Father and just saying, you can do the same thing.
Yeah, I think there's maybe a couple examples of people doing it, like in Isaiah, but it's not all over the Bible. It's not all over the Old Testament. So I think he's helping them see prayer in a new light here. Yeah, Nana?
I think something, he's just told them, you know, not to use vain repetition and keep going and going and going. But this prayer is simple and it's to the point.
Yes.
And I think that's, you know, here's an example for you, you know, so you don't have to keep using vain repetition.
Yeah, very good. All right, so our Father, where is the Father in verse 9?
In heaven.
All right, so what do you think that implies? So if our Father means intimacy and access, he says our Father in heaven.
Well, he's transcendent.
Yeah.
You know, he's immaterial. He's outside of this world, unlike the gods around him, paganism, whatever it might be.
Okay, good. And if he transcends us, that means that we have to revere him. His first thing that he's going to say in the prayer then is, hallowed be your name. We'll talk about that in just a second. But I think this also shows, okay, if he's our Father, but he's in heaven, think about how far our access goes. I mean, that's pretty impressive. Our Father who's in heaven. But putting those things together, I think, is pretty important and we shouldn't be overlooked. All right, anything else you guys want to say just until we get, or before we get to the actual prayer itself? All right. Then let's talk about the first request, or the first thing that he says in the second half of verse 9, where he says, hallowed be your name. All right, what does it mean to hallow something, or what does the word hallow mean?
Respect, highly esteem.
Okay, good. Respect to highly esteem something. What other synonyms would you use for that?
Hold in reverence.
Okay, good. To revere something, see the sacred and ultimate. The NET translation says it maybe in more modern vernacular, where it says, may your name be honored. All right, so who is that prayer for? Who's supposed to do that? Okay, so you start with us personally. Why is it helpful in prayer, rather than immediately going to, God, I need you to do this for me, and I need you to do that for me, and this and that, and this and that. He begins by saying, all right, pray with a recognition and an acknowledgement about how amazing God is. Why start there?
Well, you're going into the presence of God, and to get you to respect. I mean, he's still your father, but he's the king.
He's the Father in heaven,
right. So this, the idea about his sovereignty and who you're approaching, even though he's all these other things, you still have to remember who you're approaching.
Right.
And it gets you, and again, in the mindset so you can then properly approach him.
Right.
With these things that he already knows that's on your mind and heart.
Okay, very good.
Anybody else?
Go. Okay, good. You have to see him for who he really is. Do you think that would affect the rest of your prayer if you start with that?
Yes.
Yeah, very racist.
That's what I was going to say. When you understand where the king is and where your father is, perhaps that changes how you pray and what you pray about.
Right. Yeah, I mean, would you... I don't want to discourage people from taking any care and concern to God, but if you start with an acknowledgement of his character and his name and everything that he represents... Do you suppose there might be some things that you were tempted to pray about that now you're not going to? Because you've oriented yourself to who you're talking to. So that affects that in some ways. I would say that another realm of application of this is corporately, or the whole world. It's not just that we need to show reverence to God, but we're praying that everybody would acknowledge him for who he really is. In our prayers, do we ever pray, God, would you please help the city of Atlanta to revere you more and more and honor you more and more? And please help us to be a vehicle for that to happen and stuff like that. So it's for us, and I think it's for everybody else. Because remember, how does he start the prayer? Our, plural, Father. Our Father. I don't know if part of that is because it's a community sort of thing that we're all supposed to be doing these things together, at least Christians, but then we're hoping that other people will do the same thing. Alright, anything else you guys want to say about that so far? We've already alluded to this, but hallowed be your name. Name means the character, everything that the person stands for, everything that the person believes in. That those are the things that we also want hallowed or viewed as sacred and respected and things like that. Alright, how do you know if you honor God in your heart?
You want his will initially to be done and not yours. So in this prayer, even though you're going to ask for things, you initially, you're like, I want whatever you want. That's what I want.
Okay, good. What else? How else would we know if we revere God?
We're going to do what he tells us to do.
Okay. What are the kinds of things that outrage you? Like, on the news, if you hear about... how kids have been taken advantage of and those things ought to outrage us. But when we hear about God's name being slandered, are we just as outraged? Do those things frustrate us when things like that happen? And so our reaction, our emotional and our intellectual reaction to God not being honored, what's it like? And maybe that's something that helps us understand that. What are the reasons that we personally mourn? Is it when we appeared like we were embarrassing to other people, or is it when we really dishonored God and not done as he asked us to do? All right, so he starts out with adoration, hallowed be your name. Then he gets to the ideas of submission in verse 10, where he says, your kingdom come. All right, in the story of the Bible, Adam and Eve were created to be powerful. Mankind was created to be powerful, right? Adam was supposed to cultivate the world, and they were supposed to be fruitful and multiply and fill the world with God's image bearers. And when you get to Genesis chapter 6, you have the way that man rules ends up becoming tainted with sin, and the result is violence and power plays and all kinds of wrong sorts of things. And then throughout the rest of the Bible, the Old Testament, you've got how the kingdoms of men rule. Can you guys think of some examples in the Old Testament of kingdoms that didn't rule well because sin tainted their power?
All of the northern kings.
Yeah, okay. All of the northern kings? Any foreign kings in the Old Testament? Yeah, Amalekites. Nebuchadnezzar wrote, I think, Daniel chapter 4, and I think he did repent, but he started out pretty bad. All right, so when man tainted with sin rules, what happens?
Bad.
Really bad things. So when Jesus prays, "Your kingdom come," I think his prayer is that the way that you rule, let that be manifest. What does it look like when God actually rules something? And now, some people have suggested that this prayer is for the events of Acts chapter 2 to happen, because that's when the kingdom was established and everything like that. And so, therefore, Christians ought not pray that prayer anymore. What do you guys think about that?
Well, if you're praying that all men will come to a knowledge of the truth and can be saved, I think that's perfectly acceptable.
Right. How have we been defining the kingdom as we've been going through these classes?
It's in our hearts.
Okay, good. And so in the book of Acts, if the book of Joshua is the Old Testament book of conquest, how did they conquest people? With a sword, right? That killed people. In the book of Acts, how do they conquest people, if that's even a word?
With a sword.
With the sword of the Spirit. So the book of Acts is the New Testament book of conquest, but it's one heart at a time as people are turning to the Lord, and that's how the borders of the kingdom expand in the New Covenant. So when you pray, "Your kingdom come," the prayer is that regardless of what nation you live in physically, that more and more people would submit themselves to this king so that the world can see in these little military outposts called churches where people meet up together, if you're thinking about kingdom kind of imagery, in these little military outposts, the world can get a picture of what it looks like for God to rule. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Oh yeah, that the more that they see how Christians interact with each other, that they can get a taste of what it looks like when God rules. Because these people are submitting to the king and everything like that. All right. Anything else you guys want to say about the "Your kingdom come" business? Yeah, Ronnie?
Two chapters in front of this, he had mentioned about the fact that the kingdom is coming. You know, it's at hand.
Right.
So is it some connection to that? I mean, it's like, should we be surprised that he says this and that he's already told them it's coming, it's at hand?
Yeah, I think Jesus is ushering it in. Acts 2 is when it all becomes very official, right, and everything like that. But but the beginning stages of it, I think, are here. And so for him to pray that is that more and more people... I think it goes back to this idea of hallowed be your name, not just me, but everybody. In some ways, this is kind of saying the same thing. So, yeah. All right, so another thing he says about the submission is, "Your will be done on earth as in heaven." How does God's will get done in heaven, do you think? What do you think angels do? Yeah, and do you remember in Revelation 4 and 5, what are the beings that are closest to God, what are they doing?
Praising.
They're praising Him. Have you ever had some people that the more you've gotten to know them, the less you've respected them, and then other people that the more you've gotten to know them, the more you've respected them? The people that are closest to God and Jesus in Revelation 4 and 5, what are they doing? They're praising Him. The closer you get to Him, the more you praise Him. But the angels, I think, like in the book of Revelation, I think the book of Revelation has one third of all the references in the Bible to angels. It's all over the place. And what are they doing? Well, they're pouring out bowls of wrath, and they're doing what God wants them to do, and they're obeying Him and everything like that. They're even asked, when John attempted to worship angels, he says two times, the angel says, don't worship me, only worship God. And so in heaven, in the heavenly realm, if God says something and these angels do it, His prayer is that we would be the same thing here. That when God said something, we would honor it, we would obey it, it would immediately be something that we would respect. And Jesus is something, he models this, by the way, in the sermon, or in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he's praying, "Your will be done." Can you think about some Old Testament examples of things that were God's will that you might not have liked? And so therefore it would have been hard to pray this prayer, "Your will be done."
Nineveh being spared.
Okay, Nineveh being spared. Do you think Jonah wanted that? No, he didn't want that. But he did. He needed to submit his will to the Father's. I don't know how well of a job he did at that. What other examples in the Old Testament can you think of things that were God's will that you might not have liked?
Well, the other example would be having them go in and wipe out the Canaanites. And,
okay, good.
All those people. So it's not just the saving, it's the wiping out part.
Okay, good. Was there something else?
I said David and the child. That David prayed that, you know.
Oh, and the child was lost? Okay.
The child is still lost.
Any other examples?
When Jeremiah told the people not to resist, got a lot.
Yes. Yeah. The idea would be we have to stay in the city for protection, and he says, no, you go out to them and let them take you into exile. Like, there's so many times in the Bible where God rubs against our emotional desires. And what Jesus is expecting of us is that we are people that don't take our emotions and our desires and put it above God, but we're people that are actually willing to submit those things to God. Any comments or questions about that? I think that's a very important idea that we don't have enough time to flesh out right now.
Just real quick, just a new convert going through the Sermon on the Mount has just come to the conclusion how you had a visual reaction about my thoughts and everything else. I have to get rid of all of those.
Right.
And I mean, actually, in tears, struggling with the idea of, like, almost like, I've gotten into this, and I don't think I really want to get into this, because the demand, that's why I was interested, the demand that he's asking, when you say right after this, he talks about healing and right. These things up, and this person right now, I've got to get them from, they're right now just overloaded with the demand.
Right.
And seeing how difficult this is, and those things like that, and trying to get them to this part of healing, but this is the first person I ever experienced that just had a visual, I mean, just can feel the weight of the demand and of what Jesus is requiring.
Right. And I think if we spent less time fighting against the will of the Father and letting the will of the Father rule in our life, that we would start to experience life a little bit differently. Anything else? Yes, Samantha?
And say that it's always interesting to me in chapter 8, right after everything is like talked about with the healing, is that the man is asking, "Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean."
Right.
And even though that's on a physical level, that if we can ask that to ourselves spiritually, like, God is willing to do it.
Yes.
We just have to be willing to let him.
Okay, very good. And that goes to our character, your will be done, with the way that, not just the tragedies that happen in our life and however we would think about those things, but his will be done in the way that I view other people, the way that I am morally. He's willing to do that. But we have to be having the same desire as well. So, all right, let's move on to the petitions in verses 11 through 15. In some ways, all of this is sort of a petition, so I don't know how to characterize any of this. So I'm just doing the best that I can. I would say that with these petitions in verses 11 through 15, there's a past, present, and future aspect to all of this. And he starts with the present in verse 11. Give us this day our daily bread. Does that remind you of anything in the Old Testament? Manna. Does anybody know what the word manna means? What is it? Remember in John 6 when Jesus says that he is the bread that's come down? What were people saying about Jesus there? What is this guy? Who is it? Like, the same kind of thing. So, I don't know why I brought all that up. All right, so, give us this day our daily bread. What does that mean?
I think it's talking about physical bread.
Yeah. I think our physical necessities, not our physical luxuries. The South has a lot of wealth. And I think it can be easy to become very materialistic in any part of the United States. But this is a prayer not for a car that just looks a little nicer. This is a prayer for the things that we need every day to live. Later on in chapter 6, he's going to talk about how the birds, they don't worry. The birds don't have a refrigerator and they don't have a bunch of food stocked in their house, but they go to bed every night trusting that they're going to find seeds the next day all over the place, right? And so give us this day our daily bread. How many of you, if all the grocery stores and all the trucking industry and everything just stopped today, how long could you live for? How much food do you have to live on, do you think?
A month,
yeah. And then we look at this, give us this day our daily bread. What if we didn't even have a kitchen and we didn't have any food? Jesus is saying every day we need to be people that acknowledge that the means that he gives us to obtain our necessities ought to be viewed as a gift of God. He's not saying here, pray for your daily bread and then just sit back and don't look for a job and don't do any kind of hard work. Because how is it that we get our daily bread? How did they get the manna? They had to go out and get it. They didn't just pray for it and sit in their hammock and hope that it would just be landed right in front of them. And so the means by which you have, by God, your abilities, your education, whatever it is that you have, your finances, that all ought to be viewed as a gift from God. And so praying this prayer humbles us to know that it's God that's provided it for us, not ourselves. Alright, anything else you want to say about this one? Yeah, Danny? And then Ronnie?
Yeah, so maybe this a little bit more metaphorically, but there's a difference between existing and living. And sometimes we're going day to day, it's so overwhelming, we just don't know how we're going to get through that day. And I really feel like this should be a consolation to us when we pray that we're asking God, help us to live today, live through this day, be a blessing, be useful, be a part of a family, a community, or a relationship, be where I'm able to be involved and to be that true blessing. Because sometimes we just wake up, we just think, I've got to survive, I've got to exist. And really what we ought to be praying for is beyond that, let's live.
So that would go into a metaphorical meaning then of spiritual life and the daily spiritual bread that we need and stuff like that too. Yeah, I think there would be a double application to this. So, alright, then he goes to the past, forgive us our debts. What time is it, by the way?
8:33.
So we have about 15 minutes? Okay. Alright, so forgive us of our debts. This is the only part of the prayer that gets expanded. Because he comes back after he gives the model prayer. He comes back in verses 14 and 15 and emphasizes this again. This happens another time in the Sermon on the Mount when he talks in the Beatitudes about blessed are those who are persecuted. And then he tacks on a couple extra verses about that idea. I think there's a lot of times in the Sermon on the Mount, but there's a couple of times where Jesus says something so absolutely shocking that he comes back around to it and then gives a further explanation about it. Now, we'll get to that in just a second, but notice how sin is pictured just in these few verses. First of all, it's pictured as debt. That, by the way, you can't pay. What's the first beatitude? Poor in spirit. Right. So if you have spiritual debt, that goes back to the idea of being spiritually impoverished. In verses 14 and 15, how does he describe sin? What's the idea of a trespass?
Going beyond a boundary.
Right. You've gone somewhere that you shouldn't have gone. You've gone into a territory that doesn't belong to you. And so both of these things are used to picture what people do against us and what we've done against people and God. Have you ever had anybody do something against you and you feel like they owe you something? That's how we feel when somebody's wronged us. We feel like they owe us an apology or something. That's why maybe one reason why it's called a debt. Or a trespass, like that person violated my sense of honor or something like that. They went beyond the bounds that they should have gone in the way that they talked to me or something like that. All right, so here's my question about this. When Jesus says in verse 12, forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. What if we prayed that prayer? Does anybody here have the confidence that they could go to God in prayer and go, all right, God, I just really want you to forgive me the same way that I've forgiven everybody else around me?
I hope not.
that's a tall order. But then in verses 14 and 15, he says, if you forgive others, your heavenly Father will forgive you. So here's my question about this. What comes first? in this text? Our forgiveness or us forgiving others? What's first?
Forgiving others.
That's what this text shows, right? But I thought that the motivation and the strength for me to be able to forgive other people is looking at my forgiveness. Isn't that what Matthew 18 teaches? So how do you work through this? Because how do I ever forgive anybody unless I know my own forgiveness first? But then this text seems to flip it around. And I don't know that I have a good answer for this, by the way.
With the example of Israelites being children of God and his children, be an example of they're his children, but yet they were still making mistakes and doing things wrong and not worshiping him. So he never withdrew that being children of his, but yet he also gave consequences to what they were doing or not doing.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm asking. That would be.
So I think it's Colossians and Ephesians both say the same thing about forgive others as God first forgave you.
Right.
So I guess there is a sense of understanding. So we're back at the beginning, poor spirit and everything. You understand your situation. So before that, you didn't understand your situation. Now that I do, I think that it sounds like, at least I know it says here, that you understand that you've been forgiven.
Yeah.
That's how you're able to then reciprocate or look at
it. Right. And if you don't reciprocate,
then it says you've forgotten. I think it's in Peter, I forgot what it says. You've forgotten that you were.
That's right. That's right. I think that's the idea. Let's say that I at one point was forgiven. And then I turn around and I don't forgive other people. Could that still apply to me in verses 14 and 15? If you forgive others who trespass, your other Heavenly Father will forgive you. He'll continually forgive you, keep you in a forgiven state, or something like that. Here's maybe something to say about this then. If there's no forgiveness coming out of me, what am I failing to acknowledge or even receive maybe for my first time? What he's done. Yeah, what he's done for me. How do I lose my bitterness towards the wrongs people have done for me?
By
remembering what he's done for me.
Yep. Isn't that the parable of the debtor? Mm-hmm.
Right, that's right. And this is how a Christian can love their enemies.
Yes.
Because if an enemy has wronged me, I might think, they owe me an apology. And maybe there's times and places to have a conversation like that in a gentle, loving way. But if my attitude is really wrong about that and I have bitterness in my heart and stuff like that, I'm failing to let what God has done for me melt my heart. And if I'm dependent on what the Father's done for me and not you giving me an apology, I can love anybody no matter how mean they are to me, because my strength comes from God and not you finally giving me what I think I'm owed. That makes sense? So we're given an endless sense of strength from the Lord, which allows us the freedom to love anybody. Alright, so, and then he gets to the future. Lead us not into temptation, deliver us from evil. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. Some people bring up this tension here, that in James 1, God doesn't tempt us, but this verse seems to imply that God could lead us into temptation. I think this is just a request that temptation wouldn't overtake us. I don't think it's saying that God would lead us into it otherwise. And so we need to be praying that not only the things that we've done are forgiven, but also that we wouldn't do things in the future that would need forgiveness, that God is giving us the strength for that. All right. I'm going to have to give that one the short end of the stick there. Let's just get to fasting then. All right. Barry, do you want to read? No, Luke, do you want to read it? 16 through 18?
And when you fast, do not look gloomy like the hypocrites, for they disfigure their faces, that their fasting may be seen by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, that your fasting may not be seen by others, but by your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you.
Alright, let's just start out really briefly with understanding what fasting is. What is fasting?
Not eating.
Not eating. Some people have tried to apply, oh, well, I'm going to fast from watching this TV show, or I'm going to fast from Facebook or something like that. You can see that both of them are abstaining from something, but in the Bible, fasting means not having some kind of combination of food or water. Sometimes both, sometimes just food, but you're still having water. What's the purpose of fasting in the Bible?
To rededicate yourself to God in prayer.
Okay. What else?
I guess that's in Esther, that was the reason they said let's fast. So I guess they just wanted to focus on what their wishes were.
Okay, good. So the examples that we're thinking of, they're all dependent on circumstances. In Matthew 9, when Jesus says, when his disciples are not fasting and the disciples of John and the Pharisees are fasting, he says, hey, this is like a wedding right now. This is not the right circumstance to be fasting. And so in the Bible, fasting is something that circumstantially is something that you do. So you've got times where people, like in Ezra, they're trying to get back to their homeland in this story, I believe it was, and they're fasting and they're praying so that those things enhance one another. Sometimes in the Bible, fasting is to express national grief, personal grief, or sin, like when David lost his son, when nations aren't doing well, sometimes Northern and Southern Kingdom, they'll be fasting. We live in a society right now that has made intermittent fasting something that people do for a physical health benefit. And I am discouraged when Christians suddenly get interested in fasting if they know there's a physical health benefit to it, when the Bible always said that this is something that helps you spiritually. All right? And so the biblical emphasis is not physical health, but the average fast in the Bible is 12 to 24 hours. I think sometimes we think about Jesus fasting for 40 days. We think about Paul not having food or water for 3 days. Average in the Bible is skipping breakfast, skipping lunch, but having dinner. And so that maybe helps us think a little bit differently about fasting. But one of the purposes of fasting to express grief is when your emotions are in a certain place, fasting puts your body in the same state as your emotions, and so you have more a kind of unity with your body and your emotions in that way and stuff like that. There's a lot of things I'm not getting into right now with this. Alright, so the purpose of fasting was circumstantial. The Jews in fasting in the Old Testament, does anybody know the only day that they were commanded to fast? Day of Atonement. It says that they were supposed to afflict themselves. That's the language that's used for that. In Jesus' day, we know this in Luke 18, remember the Pharisee and the tax collector go up to pray, and the Pharisee is praying, and he's talking about how great he is, and he says, I fast twice a week. Well, they fasted Monday and Thursdays. Can you predict that every Monday and Thursday, there's just going to be something that's going to happen every Monday and every Thursday that's going to demand you to fast? Mondays and everybody knows Mondays are hard, so you might as well fast. And Thursdays, it's almost the weekend, and so that's still hard. So you might, that doesn't make sense. They just did it by rote, and they lost the meaning of it. Can Christians ever do that, where we do things by rote, and then we're not really living in reality anymore, and we're not adapting to the circumstances like we need to? That's what the Pharisees did. All right, and when they did it to be seen by men. Can you imagine Monday would have been like zombie day, where all the Pharisees are like walking around like all gloomy and sad and like, oh yeah, look at how holy they are. What Jesus says here is to actually make efforts to hide your fasting. Like make your face look really good, wash it, put oil on you so your skin doesn't look like it's, you know, really exhausted or whatever. This goes back to the overall idea of these 18 verses. When you're doing deeds of righteousness, don't try to bring attention to it. In fact, sometimes the effort that you need to make is to hide the thing that you were doing. That's good. Can you guys think of any applications of that idea? Sorry, I rushed through the information on fasting. I think it's one of the, I did a sermon on that in California, and I did. There's a lot of things about it that I think sometimes get overlooked, and so.
So I'm not sure this is the answer you're looking for, but for me personally, I think about my own experiences. I find fasting involuntary, that this is actually a reaction to the circumstances
sometimes,
that I'm dealing
yeah.
with the stress, with the anxiety, the fears, uncertainty, whatever that might be. I find myself not interested in wanting to eat,
right?
Because my attention is focused on something else, and maybe that's where the fasting comes from. It's this involuntary thing that's actually taking place within me that I'm really not interested in doing something that actually would probably comfort me. Because right. That's what food does. It is an emotional exercise to eat. And so by taking that out, all this energy is actually being given to something else.
Good. Good. Yeah. Anything else about that?
I don't know if this is right on, but I find myself whenever I'm involved in getting something done, I've got a goal to get something done. It may be a physical task I'm trying to finish, you know. I sort of start forgetting about food, and it allows me to focus on getting this thing done, which is sort of mental, even though you're taking
right.
your physical body to do it. So could it come into play that way that
I think
trying to do something spiritual, a spiritual task?
Remember the woman at the well where the disciples were sent into the Samaritan village to get food, and then they come back and Jesus says, I have food you don't know about? Because his food is to do the will of the Father. In the context, the will of the Father was him reaching out to the Samaritan woman. It was evangelism. And so he was so busy that he ended up forgetting about his hunger in that way too. So sometimes it's voluntary, sometimes it's involuntary. It depends on the circumstances again with fasting. This is why you can't make rigid rules about it. So sorry if I made that more about fasting than the actual context, but if you do it, don't bring attention to it. Don't do a selfie on Instagram of like, look at how exhausted I am, like it's a Monday and a fast day or something.
Hour 18.
Yeah. All right, thanks guys.
Maybe that's why they didn't have Thanksgiving.
Yeah.